We're going to go around with a microphone and give you an opportunity to ask questions before we wrap the evening up. So if there are certain questions either on this talk on euthanasia or the previous one on abortion that you would like to ask, we would love to hear from you, and just raise your hand and Norm will take the microphone to you. I think we have someone here on my right. Looks like there.
Thanks for your talk, and this graph is helpful. I'm curious, though, about how you would respond to people that argue that it's a human right, and whether or not maybe, you know, in some ways you think that behind that argument is probably one of these five. Mm-hmm. But I was just listening on CBC, I'll be really quick, but I was listening on CBC, an individual, and they're very pro, anyways. But, and this is a person who had assisted death preemptively to getting to the place where palliative care would be, you know, too burdensome and the like, right? So before she got to that place, she wanted to have the right to choose to die. And so I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Great question. So if someone says they believe it's a human right, I would ask a question, and I would say, where does that right come from? Who decided killing ourselves is a human right? And what established human rights doctrines actually spell this out? Because if you look at human rights doctrines around the world, they all talk about a right to life, but there's no reference at all to a right to end our lives. The other point I would make is if they say it's a human right, then they can't object to, or I would ask the question, if you say it's a human right, how can you object to Attawapiskat? How can you try to stop these teenagers from ending their lives because, after all, it's a human right? And human rights are different from, let's say, civil rights. Human rights you automatically have by virtue of being human. Then there are certain rights like the right to vote or the right to drive or the right to buy alcohol that you don't have because you exist. But if you achieve a certain age and you're able to accomplish certain things, then you get those rights. So if they say it's a human right, they're implying we have it virtually simply by being. So then how can you stop a teenager? Because they're human and they therefore have the right. And if they would object to the teenage suicide, then we start to work with that and say, okay, so if you consider in that case you ought to value someone's life enough that you won't assist their suicide, but in another case you don't value someone's life enough so you will assist their suicide, then aren't you making a judgment that that's a life worth saving and that's a life not worth saving? So who are you to decide which lives are worth saving? So to kind of get the ball rolling that way. Any other questions? Oh, good. We have two microphones. So if there's one over here.
Hi there. First of all, thank you very much for your talk. I found it very informative and also really applicable, especially the second half. I work in one of the hospitals here in Vancouver where it's not uncommon for me to hear probably at least once a week a request for MAID. And that's how we refer to it in the hospital, medical assistance in dying. And I definitely agree with all of your responses that you have noted. I think those are all really good solutions for changing this and even the volunteering component. I can definitely confirm the loneliness that people experience in hospital. I think what in reality, though, these responses are not available to people in hospital. So really, I can only speak to the experience of medical assistance in dying in a hospital setting, not in the community, but because of the limited resources that we have, none of those responses are often offered to patients besides the pain management. So I guess I'm wondering, because working in this environment where decisions are quick, not much time is given to people, how do we begin to change that environment, both on an institutional level and at a personal level for the patient? And something that I've been thinking about through all of this is modern medicine right now has the capability to keep people alive, I think, beyond a natural death. We're keeping people alive longer. So I don't know if that ties into it in any way.
Great, great questions and points. I'm jotting down notes, so hopefully I cover everything. In terms of, yes, you're right, there comes a point with technology that we can go to the other extreme where people seem to be kept alive on machines where they really shouldn't be hooked up anymore. So as Norm pointed out, you're always limited as a speaker with time. So I'll digress for one moment to draw your attention to a booklet some of you would have seen if you picked up the abortion book already, called Frequently Asked Questions About Assisted Suicide and Euthanasia. So this is also free for the taking. There aren't as many, so I hope there's a few left if you haven't gotten one yet. But this goes through things like, how do we discern what's proportionate and what's disproportionate? What's excessively burdensome with no hope of benefit? That's disproportionate. And what is not, has a hope of benefit and is not excessively burdensome. What is the principle of double effect, which is a philosophical and theological principle that helps guide moral decision making when you make a certain action and it can have a good effect and a bad effect, is it a moral action to do? So this booklet goes through all that kind of nitty gritty, as well as provides a 24-hour ethics consult line that you can call if you have questions about whether something is ethical or not. So that would go into that kind of detail. Yes, you make a very valid point that people are asking for this without the proper care being in place. And so I think, in your case, as someone who's in the medical field, you actually have legitimate grounds to object to anyone's assisted suicide. And I do use that language. I'm aware in the medical community they say medical assistance in dying. And I prefer to not use that because I find it takes away the gravity of what's going on. It makes it sound like, in a sense, palliative care should be medical assistance in dying. You're naturally dying and we're just comforting you, but that's not what they mean. So in terms of assisted suicide, if you as a medical practitioner believe something is not in a patient's best interests, and you know only their pain is being managed, but their loneliness isn't being managed, their children who have abandoned them but are looking forward to the inheritance is not being paid attention to, and other things, then you can reasonably intervene and object and not make, let's say, a religious argument, I'm Christian, I'm uncomfortable with this, but instead say, I've been working with this patient, and from what I'm observing, they're lonely and so on and so forth, and I don't think this is in their best interest because they're asking for something without all the other factors in place. So to become advocates for setting up these factors, as well as this is an opportunity for churches to rise up and say, we're going to be more intentional, as I say, that's what I'm trying, like I'm on a one-woman mission right now, to get everyone I speak to out and visiting the sick and the lonely, and that can be transformative. I would also encourage any medical personnel in the room tonight to get connected with various pro-life medical organizations. So there's Canadian Physicians for Life, and they will work with other medical people, such as nurses and so forth. So Pharmacists for Life is another organization. So if you go to my website, you can email me from there or just email me and I'd happily connect you to resources that will help you in your medical field. Microphone needed.
Do I get to go first because I got the mic first? Okay, cool. Thanks so much, Stephanie. Backtracking a little bit to your conversation about abortion, I agree with you, first of all, though I want to ask about legislating this, right? So a lot of times when people get into the abortion conversation, I completely agree with them. It shouldn't happen. It's a murder happening. But legislating abortion doesn't actually change whether or not the abortion would happen in a lot of cases. Whether it's back alley abortions, whether it's people that don't have the socioeconomic status to go off to another country or another state where it's legal and get it done in some level of safe way for the mother that would be trying to terminate this baby, it'll happen in a back alley with a coat hanger sort of thing. And in cases where that doesn't happen, say someone goes to another area, again, the abortion isn't stopped. So legislation is a harm reduction point more so than it is actually stopping the abortion, which would, in a lot of cases, happen either way. What's your response to that? Do you think that that's a fair objection to making that a one-voter issue and then things like that?
Very good question. So several points in response. In terms of legislation and whether we should have specifically laws against abortion, The best thing I think we can do is ask ourselves, are preborn children equal in dignity and value to you or me? And if the answer is yes, then we have to ask ourselves, should we have legislation that says it's unlawful to kill me, kill a five-year-old, so on and so forth? And if yes, then we have to be consistent and say, even though some people break the law and some people kill their teenage daughters, this was the case of Penny Boudreau in Nova Scotia, some people drown their children in the bathtub, which was the case of Andrea Yates, we don't legalize their actions just because they break laws. Therefore, because the preborn child is equally valuable to Penny Boudreau's daughter and Andrea Yates's five children, it ought to be unlawful to do that. But in terms of the specific concerns that people will raise that you've rightly raised, the first point I would make is legalizing something does change the numbers. You're just going to see more of it when there isn't the fear of legal consequences. And if you look at abortion statistics, for example, both in the United States and Canada, from 69 in Canada or 73 in the US when it became legal, the rates have continued to go up. And even when they've gone down a little bit, they've not dropped down in any significant way. So there's been a steady increase once it becomes legal. In terms of women dying from back alley abortions, while I'll admit certainly there were some women who did die, the numbers the abortion rights movement put forward were inflated. And in fact, Dr. Bernard Nathanson, who was a leading abortionist who fought to make abortion legal in the United States, eventually converted years later, but he came out and said, we lied about those numbers. We were in back rooms talking about making the numbers larger than they were. The more fundamental point I would make, though, when it comes to back alley abortions is to use a story, a parable, to illustrate the point. Imagine you're a nurse in an emerge and a patient comes to you with broken, swollen, bloody knuckles. So you're bandaging his wounds and you're talking to him and you say, sir, what happened that caused this? And he says, I was beating my wife tonight and this resulted. Now, would we ever respond by saying, well, we ought to legalize spousal abuse and give men boxing gloves so that when they beat their wives, they don't hurt themselves? Now, of course, everyone consistently responds, of course not, that's crazy. And I say, I agree, but here's the point the story illustrates. The point it illustrates is that we don't legalize behavior that harms one innocent person because in the course of committing the behavior, a guilty person gets hurt. And so since the preborn child is as human as a married woman, then we can't legalize an action that kills that child, even if legalizing it makes it a little bit safer for the person doing the killing. So hopefully that helps. Okay, yes.
Hello, hi. I have a question about abortion.
Sure.
Now, for a woman who may have an unwanted pregnancy, and it's a huge burden on them, they hate carrying around the baby, they hate having to, the thought of carrying this baby, you know, they might be a terrible mother if this baby gets born, and they might put it up for adoption. And is our healthcare system capable of handling all these adoptions if we go through this pro-life route? So what are your comments on that?
Mm-hmm. So, again, very good point that a lot of people raise. And I think if we look at the circumstance you've described, the parent is not going to be a good parent, they might even hurt the child, we already have those situations. And unfortunately, there is a large number of children in the foster care system who have come from abusive homes. Would we ever kill the children in the foster care system to get rid of that problem? No. So since the preborn child, again, is as human as a child in the foster care system, then if we wouldn't kill the one to deal with the crisis of a lack of adoptive homes and so forth, we shouldn't kill the other. I would also take it a step further and say, if you look at who's willing to adopt and what kind of children in majority they're willing to adopt, there is a waiting list for parents to get newborn babies. But there is a waiting list for older born children to get adoptive homes. So if someone was pregnant and they didn't want their infant and they immediately relinquished their infant into the system to be adopted right away, that child would immediately have a home. But the older kids don't have a home in large numbers. So if our standard was the lack of support and infrastructure results in us ending a life, then we actually should be killing the kids in foster care and immediately putting infants into adoptive homes because there's actually adoptive couples. Now, I use kind of a dramatic point to illustrate the point that we know intuitively that doesn't make sense. And therefore, yes, this isn't an easy solution, is the point. It's also going to take us as Christians remembering that scriptural call to care for orphans and widows. What are we doing to focus on adopting not just infants, but adopting children who've been in the system for 4, 5, even 10 years or more, and saying, hey, this is an orphan child that I'm going to love and care for, and becoming more generous within our families.
Hi, I have a question about abortion. What questions would you ask to somebody who says that life ends when the heart stops beating, so therefore life begins when the heart starts beating?
Very sharp question. So when someone says life ends when the heart stops beating, the difference between that and the first 21 days of an embryo's life when there is no heartbeat, because the heart starts beating at 21 days, is that a living thing cannot come from a dead thing. So if you look actually back in the old science textbooks, there used to be this idea of spontaneous generation where people saw, you know, dirty rags in the corner and then some mice came out from under them. So they used to think those mice, the living things, spontaneously generated from a non-living things, those dirty rags. And the scientists who came afterwards said, no, spontaneous generation is not possible. Living things come from other living things. So you can't come from a non-living thing. So if you're alive at 21 days when you have a heartbeat, you couldn't have been dead for the first 21 days of your life, because that living thing cannot come from a non-living thing. So the difference then between that and the end of life is in the timeline of a human being's life, as well as other species, actually, in the early stages, you have abilities to do things that the older versions within our species are incapable of doing. So if my brain is taken out of my body, I'm dead. If my heart is taken out of my body, I'm dead. But the embryo is actually cooler than me, because the embryo, for the first 21 days, doesn't have a heart. And for the first few weeks, there's no brain activity. The brain activity has been detected at 6 weeks, and yet has this amazing ability to grow and develop and mature through the stages of human development, which is something I cannot do, because at that age, they have that ability. Great question.
I just had a question. What's your opinion about birth control, where potentially it flushes out a fertilized egg at some point in relation to abortion? And would you consider that abortion?
Good question. When it comes to, well, there's two kinds of birth control. There's birth control that is contraceptive, so against sperm and egg even getting together. And then there's birth control that might prevent sperm and egg from getting together, but also might work after sperm and egg have come together. So in the case of hormonal contraception like the birth control pill, if you read the medical literature, it's described as having three mechanisms. The first is to suppress ovulation, so there's no egg. So if there's no egg and a woman is sexually active, there's no egg for the sperm to fertilize. But sometimes that fails, so there's another mechanism within the birth control pill to change the cervical mucus in a woman's body so that if she has sex, the cervical mucus makes it more difficult for sperm to pass up through her reproductive organs to get up to the tube where there would be an egg that got released. But that sometimes fails. So the third mechanism is to change the lining of the uterus, making it thinner than its normal thickness. And we know the birth control pill has this effect because a woman on the birth control pill has a lighter period than a woman who isn't on the pill, which is a sign that she has a thinner uterine lining rather than a thicker one. Here's where this is significant. If she's ovulated, if she has sex, and if the sperm get to that egg, fertilization, a new human being who becomes an image bearer, is there. And a week later, when that human being moves to implant in the uterus, they don't become human, they just change their environment. And if the effects of the hormones are such that it prevents that human being from implanting in the uterus, then yes, that image bearer will bleed out in a very early abortion, which will not be detected by the woman as such because it's early in pregnancy, the embryo would be too small, it's just going to look like a period. So a lot of people are unaware of that. So I would say we have to be consistent. And since science tells us life begins at fertilization, and since God tells us man and woman were very good, not just good like the rest of creation, and made in God's image. If we know we have life, we know it's in God's image, we have to be consistent. And whether someone is killed a few weeks later surgically or whether they're killed really early chemically, either way, it's killing. Then there's barrier methods that just prevent sperm and egg getting together, such as condoms, and a whole other presentation could be given on that. I definitely have concerns and object to even barrier methods because I look at the nature of sexual intimacy and how a husband and wife should reflect the love of Christ to his church, and that Christ's love was total, and it was faithful, and it was fruitful, and it was free. And that the only relationship that God allows sexual intimacy in the relationship that's to reflect Christ's love to the church, which should be total, fruitful, faithful, and free. And that when a couple has sex, God has designed it so the man is always fertile. And he intentionally designed it so the woman is not always fertile. So that if a couple engages in an act of sex by using some kind of barrier method, they're withholding the gift of fertility. They're rejecting the gift of fertility. And that's not total. And is that something that reflects God's love, or is God's love whole? The final point I'll make, because again, a whole other talk could be given on this, it's understandable that there are times where a married couple might say, look, we are so stressed with loving the children right here. We can't have another child right now. We have serious reasons to not have a child. And this is where we say, how has God made us? And as I said a moment ago, God has made it so that the woman is not always fertile. And so you can learn, and in fact, I know I was talking to Michelle today. She interviewed me and she told me that she knows all about natural methods of fertility awareness, which are not the rhythm method, which is a calendar method, which just doesn't work. But knowing a woman's changes to her cervical mucus, or even peeing on a stick and putting the stick in a machine and that machine reads your hormone levels. So there's very modern ways of knowing when are you fertile and when are you not? When has God made me able to conceive a child? And when is he not? And determining a married couple's sexual activity around that biology that God stamped into our being.
I wanted to ask about the pain management portion, and this is a case I've heard when I was first introduced to the topic of euthanasia, and I don't know how rare this is or if it even happens, but basically, if the pain for a terminal patient is too great, and if the dosage required to manage that pain would be lethal, would administering that sort of dosage be equivalent to trying to help him, but at the same time ending his life? Would that be something you'd argue against?
Good point. I'll answer briefly and then in the interest of the time point you to this booklet. And if anyone didn't get a copy of the booklet because we're out, then please email me because I can send you a PDF version of it. But what this talks about is the principle of double effect, which is this old theological and philosophical principle which says, we can't do evil to bring about a good, like killing a stranger to get their heart to save someone else, like I used earlier. We can only do good actions to bring about a good, but sometimes when we do good actions, there's good and bad effects. And we can justifiably do the good action that has a bad effect if the good effect is equal to or greater than the bad effect and ultimately flows from the good action, not the bad effect. So if someone is in excruciating pain, then according to the principle of double effect, you can administer pain medication, even if that shortens their life, because the administration of the pain medication is not to end their life, but it's to alleviate their pain. That's very different from saying This person is in pain, and I know this level of morphine will help them, but this next level will kill them, so I'm just going to give them the next level. In that case, the principle of double effect wouldn't apply because you're actually giving more pain meds than needed. But if they're in pain, you give the level needed to alleviate the pain, and that's a good action. In brief, but go to this. And I'm going to keep going until Norm says we should stop, just so you know. I leave it to you. I'm not sure where the mics are, but if you just start talking through a mic. Oh, wait, is that Norm? I don't. Okay, Norm is not on the microphone. Is that Aaron? I can't even see up here.
Hi. Hi, and thank you for this talk. Thank you for your time. I wanted to ask this is now going to assisted suicide, regarding doctors. The only thing I can think of is like lethal injection, which would be the death penalty, of how they first they paralyze you and then they administer the dose, and in that time supposedly they're aware that they are paralyzed and that there's this switch and then they get the lethal dose. People don't seem to have a problem with that because they're getting the death penalty because they're bad people, but my curiosity with doctors is twofold. One is, how can doctors even do this? Because their oath specifically says that they wouldn't kill people. And secondly, to go with that, what would that look like in changing your mind? Because I know that there's been lots of people that have tried to commit suicide with pills, and then they made themselves vomit because they didn't want to because they changed their mind. So what does that look like, with the government allowing this to go on with our doctors?
Mm-hmm. So you raise an important point that this new law in legalizing the killing of someone with assistance creates a whole host of problems that I don't think the government has really thought through. What if someone wants to change their mind, but they're paralyzed and they can't communicate that? Or what if they are thinking of changing their minds, but their family's gathered around, and so they're thinking, it would be kind of weird after I've said all my goodbyes to say I don't want to do this anymore. So they almost, again, they feel guilted into doing it. You raise a good point about the death penalty, and I would point out a very interesting fact that I like to bring up. Pfizer, the major pharmaceutical company, came out in May of last year objecting to the fact that they found out some American states were using their pharmaceuticals to execute prisoners. And Pfizer said, we are in the business to save lives, not end lives, so you can't use Pfizer's products for the death penalty. And by the way, it doesn't matter that these are legally sanctioned deaths, we don't want to be involved in it. So my response is, well, that's great, but hey, if that's what we say about guilty criminals, that the medical community shouldn't be ending life, then how much more should we be saying that about, you know, innocent patients in our hospitals? So this is where it can be helpful to study the history of the Holocaust. Before killing Jews, there was all the killings and experimentation on the sick, the disabled, and the elderly, and euthanasia was in full swing, which was a part of the Holocaust. And one of my friends in med school at UBC, his whole class had to study an article by Holocaust survivor Elie Wiesel, and one of the points he wrote about Elie Wiesel was the involvement of physicians in the killing of prisoners. And he makes this one point. He says, the physician could have simply decided not to kill. And so that's what we need to encourage our pro-life physicians to do, is say, yeah, I've taken an oath, the Hippocratic Oath. I'm in this business to comfort, to heal, if possible, to cure, but never to kill. And so that's, again, where contacting me so I can connect any medical people here to pro-life medical organizations so you know you're supported. And then I would also point out, on my website, you can go to my blog, and within the past 2 to 3 blogs, I have one called If We Remain in the Margin, if we'll be marginalized if we remain in the margin, something like that. And it's written specifically to medical personnel to talk about how they can frame their objection to assisted suicide and other topics from the lens of it being bad medicine rather than it simply being my religious view. Because people are going to start to say, well, then don't be a doctor, because medicine is about doing things, and if your religion says no, but It's medicine is about doing good medicine. And so we want to make strong arguments for why we object to euthanasia, that it's not good medicine. And so that article will help. Oh, take one more. I'm going to take a final question.
Hi. I just wanted to ask about the public discourse and how we've been shamed. I'm on a college campus right now, and people are celebrating abortion on Twitter, and there's this whole, you know, do what you want to do, yet the public discourse, even in churches, we're shamed for bringing up the abortion word. The House of Commons hasn't raised the issue for years because it's so politically incorrect. So I just want to know how we can bring public discourse to kind of the campus culture, and also for people that don't believe that there is a God and that we are created in His image.
So I think we need to begin by taking the first step forward ourselves and raising our voices, and that's not easy. And there may be persecution that comes from it, but that's the history of the church. The early church martyrs were persecuted and willing to die for their faith. Dr. Martin Luther King, in his letter from Birmingham jail, said there was a time when the church was very powerful. It was in those days when the early Christians rejoiced at being deemed worthy to suffer for what they believed. He said, in those days, the church was not merely a thermometer that recorded the ideas and the principles of popular opinion. He said it was a thermostat that transformed the mores of society. He said, whenever the early Christians entered a town, the people in power became disturbed and immediately sought to convict them for being disturbers of the peace and outside agitators. And he said, but nonetheless, they pressed on with the conviction that they were a colony of heaven, called to obey God rather than man. He said, small in number, they were big in commitment. They were too God-intoxicated to be astronomically intimidated. And he said, by their effort and example, they brought an end to the ancient evils of infanticide and gladiatorial contests. So I would say that we need to capture that sacrificial spirit. We need to encourage our fellow Christians in the pews, in the seats, to do that. We need to ask our shepherds, our pastors, our leadership teams to lead by example. But ultimately, all we can control is us. And if we take that first step, that will naturally, magnetically draw other people in to want to follow. So I would encourage that. There's so much more I could say. You could see, as my family says, I'm extremely verbally abundant. I will pass it over to Norm. Thank you.